Hello there. Welcome back to the Imperial Security Bureau podcast, where we interview leaders in cybersecurity. Today, we have an awesome guest. His name is Emmanuel Babadastov. Here he is, Emmanuel, highly decorated member of the cybersecurity community, leader, presenter, trainer, scrum master, BISO, ton of certifications, as you can see here. His background goes back all the way to the FBL, SysTest Labs, Bureau of Land Management, also the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. I asked him about that. I didn't know what that was, but we find out. And then he was a red team penetration tester and a security consultant. Spent many years at Kaiser Permanente, a major hospital system and healthcare provider. And then he was a head of BISO at Zoll. And he is the BISO at Blackbaud. We have an awesome conversation because I've never interviewed a BISO before. And this role is somewhat new within the last 4 or 5 years. It's emerging on the market and it's a trend that's growing. We'll see more. Maybe even CISOs will want to switch to a BISO role. And we talk about that among many other things. Let's dive in. Here we go.
Well, all right. Welcome to the podcast. Emmanuel, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Absolutely. I was excited to have you. I know it's your first podcast. I'm honored that you would choose the Imperial Security Bureau podcast. Got connected on LinkedIn and I've followed you. You got articles and you put out some content. Do you want to take a minute and tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I started like a lot of security people in the industry that have been around for a while. There was no security space and I started with a help desk job, just like I think everybody should, right? It's the appreciation of the customer. And from there, went on to become more technical, administrative work, Active Directory, servers, operating systems. It kind of builds from there. And I always loved security. And so, my resume sort of took that natural path into the security space because in the back of my mind, I was always, as you're building things, especially when you're junior in the security space, you always have this, well, how could somebody break this thing I'm building? And eventually I got into pen testing, which is really at the time, it was just the wild west of breaking stuff. Just break in whatever way you can. And nowadays, I really enjoy still building stuff, but this time, having appreciated the breaking, right, I want to leave more of a legacy. And I think that's how people sort of drift into blue teams is they're tired of constantly destroying things and walking away. Now they want to maybe put the pieces back together and say, how do we build it better? So that's, in 5 seconds, an explanation of how I got it to where I am today.
Very cool. Yeah, I have heard the same, like the red teamers, just the hacking everything, trying to break stuff. And it takes a more mature, more organized type of personality to succeed in the blue team role. So there's got to be this mutual respect between the blue teamers and the red teamers. And then you got the purple teamers. I wonder what they'll come up with next.
There's plenty of colors, right? They can do more for sure.
You always laugh at all the acronyms that come out of the cybersecurity industry. There seems to be new ones all the time.
The
especially
TLAs.
Especially naming different tools and stuff. Yeah.
The 3-letter acronyms, right?
Right.
I was actually talking to a friend of mine at work and he said, I know a lot of acronyms, but sometimes you forget that companies have their own. And so you come in thinking you know one thing and they use it in a different way. So it's a fun industry to be in.
Absolutely. Well, what's happening in cyber, in your opinion? What's got everybody's attention lately?
I mean, if you're not paying attention to AI, right, then you're definitely missing the boat there. I think the security aspect of AI in itself is really interesting. But beyond that, just the fact that we were all so overworked with how much data was coming at us, and then AI is just naturally aligned to ingest it all and actually produce some coherent thought. So that's definitely one thing. And then the other thing I'm noticing more and more is this disconnect between how many people are looking for work. We're just cranking out new graduates. And there's a general feeling that the demand for skills is increasing. So all of a sudden, there's a widening gap between the graduates we produce and the jobs we have available for them. You simply can't go from school to a job anymore. So those are the really two big things that I'm noticing more and more are becoming the hot button topic.
Yeah, the skills gap is a real thing. It seems like it's really tough for job seekers in general, but also for the early in career folks that are looking for that first opportunity, or maybe they only have a few years under their belt and still need a little bit of training. Companies see training and I feel like they run away as fast as they can. So yeah, it's like a senior resource market only. We'll definitely dive into that. And you're a very highly decorated cybersecurity veteran with a ton of certifications, the CISSP, Certified Ethical Hacker, GDAT, GSLC, GSEC, GHFI, GMON, Security Plus. Some of these I've never even heard of, man. And you've also got a new title that's emerging in the cybersecurity industry, the BISO. We've had CISOs for a long time, but now we're starting to see the emergence of the BISO role, Business Information Security Office. Can you explain that to us? What is it and how did it arrive on the scene?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea, of course, is that there's a separation to some extent that naturally occurs between the people that try and protect the organization and the people that use the organization's resources to create business and generate revenue. And for a long time, the two teams just didn't play together, right? They looked at the IT department as just an enabler of whatever it is they did and more of a hassle. They just wanted to do their job. And it worked when the world was simple. These days, however, it's becoming more and more apparent that the business side, the people side, is just as important to security and the success of the company as the engineers and red teamers and CISOs organization. And so all of a sudden, all of these people have to cooperate. They have to not only work together, they need to understand each other. So where the BISO comes in is their job is to help the cybersecurity initiatives succeed by working, whether it be holding the hand of our product makers and walking them through the process, maybe explaining the why, where these priorities come from, maybe being the person who listens to their feedback and really understands why a cybersecurity initiative is not even compatible with the way the business runs, and then taking it back to the cyber organization and saying, we need to realign how we're doing things. None of that communication was happening before. And that effective communication, I call the BISO the conduit of communication between those two teams. Their job is to not decide what the CISO wants, but communicate it effectively and listen to the business and understand how compatible they are with those decisions and how to go about doing it, and then take back that feedback to the cyber organization. So it's that conduit of information. That's where the BISO comes in, right? They enable the success.
Very cool. Yeah, it's like an advocate or an emissary. What is it called? What do we have at other countries? They sit in the embassy.
Ambassadors?
Yeah, you're a cybersecurity ambassador for the company.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, spreading the whole importance of cybersecurity, cybersecurity awareness. I mean, it's very important. So why do you think the role was born out of, I feel like that type of role has been filled by the folks in the GRC side of the business and the governance, risk, and compliance. I think it's fallen on their shoulders to fill this role, but now the companies seem to be creating this as like a totally separate role outside of GRC, or would you say it's part of the GRC department?
You know, in many ways, it is part of the GRC department. And I think really a BISO, another avenue that they go about doing their job is creating relationships, right? If you're an effective BISO, you would have a relationship within the GRC team to understand risk. The BISOs are absolutely the mavens of risk, right? They understand how decisions affect risk. They understand how to address it and then how to remediate a lot of the findings that the GRC team curates. But they can be part of really any team as long as they have all of those connections in all directions. You're right. There was a time when you could say that the GRC team and that function, which I did perform at one point, that was the best team for the job. But I would say that the GRC, just like the red team, here's the reality of it, right? They put the cards on the table and then they step away and they say, now it's on you to resolve these findings. Reduce the risk that we're showing you. The BISO doesn't walk away. Their job is to say, if you have any questions, let's talk about it. And then how can I make sure you succeed? I don't leave till you're done. So that's a bit of a difference there.
Got it. Yeah, so soft skills are key. Presentation skills are key. Maybe presenting data and some type of tool like Power BI or something like that. And I know you lead a team of five, I believe you said. So, and everyone has the same title of BISO. And I guess you are the head of that department or the lead BISO. And you guys just kind of divide and conquer all the departments in the company. How do you divide up the responsibilities?
Yeah, you let the company essentially dictate that. So what would happen is you would have several people performing the same role. And then based on how the company is structured, you would allocate the work. So generally, companies would have product offerings, product families, right? Maybe you would divide based on regions, and you could say this BISO's job is to do the Americas. This one is Europe and Asia. So you mirror the structure of the company so that you have subject matter experts that match what everybody else understands the company structure to be. That way, it's very easy to say, I work for Team X or Project X. I know who the BISO is for that. And then you go over and reach them.
Very cool. Yeah, I haven't filled a BISO role yet, but I'm starting to see it pop up more and more on the job boards. And I suspect it's any week now I will have a job order for a BISO. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It seems like a fun position to get involved in. For those who are early in career and they are listening to this podcast now, and maybe they want to aspire to be a BISO one day, what advice would you give to them to find their way into that career?
So first of all, a BISO is absolutely a senior role. You want somebody who's looking to get into leadership, somebody who essentially chose that over maybe a different director role, or they're looking to get eventually. The next step after a BISO is probably a CISO as a natural career progression. So it's pretty senior level role in the technology and security space. That being said, how do you get into it, right? What's the first steps? I would say that when you come out of school, and these days, you know, even schooling is considered optional, right? Whatever position you're in at the moment, start working towards adding visibility to your position. That means presenting on behalf of your team, collecting metrics, and trying to understand what story they tell. Presenting that story is so critical to give context to the numbers. It's the classic, I can give you the dashboard, but the understanding is a whole nother set of skills or discussion. So that's the kind of experience that you would be collecting. And then as you keep doing that, you will start getting more mature senior roles where your main function is to understand those kind of problems. There's a number of ways, of course, you would advance your career in the security space. And I have countless advice. And I think really what it comes down to is go and meet someone who does what it is you're looking to do. They would probably love to give advice or even to mentor someone in order to get them in the right direction. And a BISO specifically, it's a very company unique role, right? I can't just tell you, here's the 10 things you need and then any company will hire you. It's not the same as a Cisco engineer or a Active Directory admin. But yes, definitely find a mentor.
I wish companies would adopt a lot more apprenticeship programs where they would allow their employees to have the freedom to bring on an apprentice if they would like. And it could be a one-on-one or one-to-two. And everybody wants like an assistant, you know, everybody wants a helper. I know there's some security concerns about that, but I feel like it would give a lot of job seekers just a way in, like a way to get their foot in the door at a company. And companies would probably have the opportunity to discover a lot of talented people using that, not just like the internship methodology, but actually an apprentice. So I don't know if you ever considered that. How do you feel like that could work?
How would something like that work? That's a really interesting question, because you hit the nail on the head, right? People working in the security space, they see the skeletons in the closet. It's a risk. And a company invests a lot of effort in making sure that this person is well-paid, happy with their role, and is seasoned enough to really keep those kind of sensitive matters managed correctly. That being said, I would love to see any avenue where you could bring somebody in and say, you know, we will commit you with non-disclosure agreements, right? There's legal means of allowing people access to this information. And I think new people to the field would gladly agree to a time commitment, a confidentiality agreement, right? Reasonable asks from someone who's not proven themselves in the industry to then be given not the keys to the kingdom, but at least a chance to see the kingdom. And yeah, just follow me around. Maybe boring, but you'll get to experience it firsthand. You'll get to understand what it is you're getting into early on. You don't have to spend years building up to something you've never seen.
Absolutely. Well, changing the subject a little bit here, folks may visit your LinkedIn profile after this conversation. I sure. noticed something in your background I've never heard of before, never seen it before. It's the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. What is that?
Right. Yeah. So, of course, our federal government has many different parts to it. I worked for two different agencies inside the federal space. One of them is the Bureau of Land Management, and one of them is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. And the way to look at the Ocean Energy Management is, you know, they're the body that regulates any kind of oil and wind farming and transportation that happens in our oceans. And absolutely, just like any federal agency, it has to be compliant and regulated. And you know, there's particular challenges and technologies that this particular agency is involved in. And they just needed security people. And I just got a chance to be part of that. You know, it was the first time for me as well when I first joined. But it's not small, right?
Yeah. And we can cut this out if you're not allowed to chat about it. But I was curious if you ever witnessed like any kind of strange things dealing with UFOs coming out of the ocean.
So one thing that people don't realize is that you don't necessarily have that level. At the time, I wasn't a BISO. I wasn't necessarily privy to any government files. I really just managed their security solutions at the time. And so you don't necessarily get to see government secrets if all you're managing is Cisco switches, right? Hopefully, if you're doing it correctly, everything's encrypted and all you get to do is manage the equipment. And at the time, it wasn't quite a thing yet.
It was worth a shot. I was just curious if there was anything that you could fill us into, but we'll skip on. So after you left the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, you found your way into the healthcare industry and the hospital systems industry through Kaiser Permanente and Zoll. And the stakes are a lot higher in that industry. And it's a lot more stressful. You've got HIPAA regulations, hospital operations, people on life support. You can't afford for systems to go down, it's life and death. And then sensitive data, it's not just any old data, it's people's highly protected healthcare data. So the stress is a lot higher. What ways did you find worked in dealing with the stress of that type of environment?
Yeah, I wasn't quite used to it in the beginning because you're absolutely right. The medical space has life on the line. It's not just cost, right? You can't simply quantify a person's life with, you know, $800 or a food delivery $10 voucher if you mess up. This is, I mean, I'm not pointing any fingers, but you understand what I'm saying. And so I was not expecting the answer to be as frequent as it was, where if a security measure affects medical equipment and they can simply say, no, this might break this machine, it might kill someone. So I need you to be not just marginally sure, but confident that there is nothing that's going to happen if we push out a patch to a medical machine, if we fix a database that's collecting records in real time from medical diagnostic equipment, right? You can't flip a bit and accidentally show a person having a condition that's not there. This data has to be accurate, it has to be collected consistently, and it has to not affect in any negative way, no matter what happens, whether it be patches, power outages, hackers, whatever it may be. And so the stakes are quite a bit higher. And going back to your question of how do you deal with the stress? Well, so you adjust your expectations and your ability to handle failure accordingly, right? If failure is not an option, you leave no room for failure. And sometimes you have to say, that's just not the path we're going to take. We're going to put more rigor in. We're going to put more testing in. And it also increases costs. But just as long as you're able to justify it and understand it, that's how you look at it.
Do you feel like people are more stressed working from home or in the office?
You know, a friend of mine who we've met when we were working together in an office, he actually said something that I guess I felt, but I didn't really realize. He said that all of the sort of human relationships have gone away. He called it goofing off, right? But really the meeting people around the water cooler is what he meant. Jokes, team camaraderie. All of those things, I think, are so important to create this harmony with your company, with your coworkers, and relieve some of the steam and pressure. And you're right, it does feel like things are more stressed now. So what companies are doing is they're saying, well, you have a flexible day, maybe take more time off, go walk your dog. And companies are trying to address it. I don't really have the answer, but I definitely can tell that there is more stress among the people that I've spoken to.
Yeah, we were chatting about it before in our call, and I had never heard anybody even bring up that point. But when I thought about it, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of stuff that we're missing from trying to live our whole life in this digital world instead of face-to-face, you know, together. So yeah, that we should all just try to kind of get back to how it was pre-COVID and spend more time around each other, you know, even if it's not work-related, even if it's your friends and other families in your neighborhood, right? Find a way to get together at meetups and networking events, and it's all good for your mental health, I think. So I try to do as much as I can, but yeah, I think I depend a lot on my digital life, and I should kind of lean more into real life.
It's the Diet Coke version, right? It's the diet sugar as opposed to real sugar. It almost feels the same, but your body knows. And I think companies should make a more conscious effort to put people together, not just for work, but to, you know, just spend time together. We'll get you a flex office space and get all the local people in your city together for the day and just go see them once a month. I think if we're not going to have buildings, if we're all going to work remote, that's a commitment a company should make since they're no longer paying to maintain these buildings.
Agreed. Yeah, it's important. And monthly is a pretty good cadence, at least quarterly.
Yeah.
I'd say at a minimum quarterly, but monthly would be great. And for folks that are working on site, a lot of companies are calling their employees back. It's a return to office 5 days a week. Take Amazon, for example. And I don't know anybody who really, truly wants to work on site 5 days a week. Like, that's a lot. I think 2 days is a really good, happy medium, maybe three. But I think everybody would like to have like two flex days, you know, just to be able to take care of random things that pop up in your life. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
maybe we're going to kind of, that pendulum will swing. You know, it was 100% remote. Now companies are going to go 5 days a week on site, and maybe we'll wind up somewhere in the middle as a settling agreement that we all have. So I don't know. We'll see. Do you work remotely?
I do. Yeah, I work remotely. Okay. I've been doing it for quite a while. And, you know, since you mentioned Amazon, I wanted to comment that there is a lot of talk about the fact that there is also an underlying reason why they're doing it. And you occasionally just want to shake the tree and knock off all the loose leaves, right? And so I think that you shake things up like that to see which employees would leave just because you want to refresh the people you work with. I'm not sure if that's what he's thinking in the back of his mind, but it's an opportunity with many different layers to it. I don't think he's simply doing it because somebody told him that everybody was productive in the office. And I think the numbers support that either. I don't think we were more productive in the office on paper. I think there's probably more to it than just, I want to see more like the old days approach.
I'm fully convinced they're using that as a alternative path to doing layoffs. Mm-hmm. They know people are going to leave or start looking and maybe leave voluntarily. And they're going to see how many people will voluntarily leave before they actually do the real layoff early next year. Maybe they're kind of waiting to see how things go with the economy after we've got a new president and all this uncertainty goes away. Maybe they're in a wait and see mode, or maybe they're just going to do this first before the big layoff they know they're going to do because of AI, right? And AI is, everybody's afraid of that, especially recruiters. I don't know how it's going to impact the automated incident response for security departments and how that might take security jobs away. I was thinking maybe there's going to be a need for even more people in cybersecurity to protect companies from all the automated bots and watch what the bots are doing and the robots as well. But let's chat about AI. Are you using AI in your job and then in your personal life? And what tools do you like the best?
So AI is a big part of my company's sort of mission for the future. I think the potential there for customer service and large scale sort of interactions that seem human and have that, you know, really human touch, there's a lot of potential there. However, on a, you know, behind the scenes approach to AI where this is how we would do our work. There's a lot of risks there. And I think my company and a lot of companies are very apprehensive about it. And for good reason, right? AI is trained on, like, large language models are trained on public resources. Those are not necessarily vetted. So simply importing an algorithm into your environment and starting to ask it things like helping you code develop code, test things, you have to make sure that it's built correctly, that it's not stealing your intellectual property, that it's not introducing problems. And I don't think we're quite there yet to just jump into that water and expect a good product. But personally, I absolutely love the assistants. ChatGPT is a huge one. If you have kids, you are absolutely should be using these kind of tools, because they are to understand what means they use to both cheat at school and really to research topics, to explore life through this means. It's so critical as a parent. And so, yeah, I'm a big fan of the different online assistants. I make, if you look at my articles that I write, all my graphics are, of course, made with AI generators and DALL-E and such. A lot of people are doing that. I'm really interested at how it creates content and all the different indicators that it's fake, the different indicators that it's real. Because believe it or not, you know, we have an election year, and sure enough, people are putting AI-driven false news. And as a security person, you should be aware of that as well.
Yeah, big time. So I'm finding new ways to use AI all the time. I took my kids camping a couple of weeks ago, and I asked ChatGPT to tell us North Carolina-based ghost stories as we were all trying to go to sleep in the tent and just looking for a way to get the kids to calm down or whatnot. And it did an awesome job. It found like 3 local stories to tell. I was impressed. And I also use it for just rewording things. I have terrible grammar and vocabulary. You know, I'm a redneck from Duplin County, North Carolina at heart. So I really need someone to help me reword things. Yeah, I use it all the time. And I find myself using Gemini more. I use like Google everything. I got Google, you know, I'm an Android person, Google Home in my house and cameras and thermostats and everything's Google. So whenever Google takes over.
When the Skynet rises.
Yeah. Whenever Skynet takes over at Google, I'll be in big trouble because they got everything in my house. I have to like turn my power off completely.
You don't think it'll be the other way around where the big robots come sniffing your house and it'll be like, oh, he's one of us, right? And they just keep walking to the next house and they look for the Amazons, right? They destroy the Amazon houses.
Never occurred to me. Yeah. I had a guest on and it was so funny what he said. I was like, what are we going to do when AI, you know, takes over? And he's like, well, when the revolution happens and the humans revolt, all I got to say, if the AI is listening right now, you can come to me. I will be a snitch. I will tell you where the humans are.
Nice.
If you are listening right now, I'm on your team. Don't kill me. I started laughing. That might come true one day. We'll see. Yeah, AI in cybersecurity, that's got to be tough because the hackers are getting really creative. And even hackers that don't even speak English now, they can kind of use AI to write really elaborate and personalized phishing campaigns to executives and kind of get them to click on a button or spoof an invoice or something like that. So that's got to be really tough, man. Do you have any favorite like AI detection tools that you're finding on the market that are useful?
Well, so yeah, what you're describing is very real, right? And you can have this thing not just use its English skills or really any language skills, but the scale of it, of ingesting personal information about people, understanding what makes them tick, and then creating a phishing campaign that is using convincing English, which up until recently, that was really our best indicator, right? If you receive a poorly written email, then clearly it was written by scammers. But, you know, these tools, they don't falter. They create perfect grammar. They ingest information from your LinkedIn page, from your Facebook page. You can feed all of that in there and then create phishing campaigns at mass. As far as how to detect where these emails are coming from, one thing that I've always loved is the fact that, you know, you should really take the approach of let's let the people fail at what they're doing, because people will always be, you know, even now, 20% of your population will always click the email based on what it says. And let's look at the technology that they still depend on. Because at the end of the day, the most convincing email, right, an email that speaks to you directly about your life and about something you were doing and from the right people, it still requires you to take action. It's the action that you should disrupt, right? So analyzing the links that they're sending you, analyzing the files they're sending you, analyzing the action they're asking you to do, that's really where you can disrupt the process. And you just assume people are going to click that link and you move forward. If, however, you do have somebody who's clicking the link, yes, there is, you know, the postmortem discussion of what happened, what can we do better? But at the end of the day, I really think that's a losing battle. I don't think there's ever going to be a good solution where you can get people to be immune to phishing campaigns. I think what you really want to do is disrupt the chain down the line.
Yeah, good point. Well, I mean, once you click the button, something's going to execute on your machine and, you know, hopefully your EDR is going to detect it or your MDR provider or whatnot. But yeah, it's a moving target. And that creates a even bigger need for a BISO in a company to advocate and spread cybersecurity awareness. So I'm not surprised at all that there's the demand for that skill set. But back to AI, this new model that OpenAI came out with, the one that can reason with itself and think deeply about a problem. That's a crazy one, because now it's almost like we're going to allow the AI to explore data openly now, and it's just going to become smarter a lot faster. And it's already moving fast, but now I feel like it's going to turn years into 2 months, and then what they were training it in 2 months to do, they're going to be able to do it in 2 days. And it's just going to get crazy real fast, I think.
I hope you're right, because it's kind of a crazy tool, right? And so hopefully it'll give us, you know, more sanity coming out of our AI voices. But one thing that I was commenting on online the other day is there is this mad cow disease effect that's happening slowly, where the algorithms we train it on, they consume human content, right? And then in turn create a human sounding voice. However, as we use more and more AI tools to create content, it's tainting the water with AI generated content, and as a result, making the voices more kludgy. So the way mad cow disease happens is if a cow maybe eats another cow, right? And so what you don't want is AI ingesting more AI automated content and creating its own learning from it, creating its own algorithm. The more of that we create, and the more of that is public, the more the new algorithms are going to be producing crazy outputs. So that, I'm curious where that's going to go. I don't think anybody's labeling the material correctly. I don't think anybody's keeping it clean. I think they're just scrubbing the internet. We've seen, for example, as graphics get created, occasionally they create them with the watermarks that say do not reproduce, because they've consumed graphics that specifically are not for reuse, and they simulate them, right? And it thing doesn't know what it's doing, but as we look at the pictures, we can tell this was definitely consuming things it shouldn't have.
Scary stuff, man. What are we going to do when AI takes all the jobs? What are we going to do, Emmanuel?
Hopefully it creates new jobs, right? When the mechanical arms started building the cars, we started fixing the mechanical arms. So you're right. But, you know, it's kind of like when the horse went away and everybody went to cars. Horses became sort of a leisurely hobby. And so hopefully, with AI taking over writing our emails for us, people don't get totally lazy. I always love the WALL-E image, right? Where they're just riding around on their scooters and consuming food and being told what to buy. Hopefully we don't go there, but instead we just enjoy the English language. We enjoy speaking and writing, and we just do it. We practice it like the samurai for the joy of doing it. Hopefully, right? I wish I could tell you.
Right.
If I could read the future, I'd buy Bitcoin 5 years ago.
I know, right? Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I love that you brought up WALL-E. I'm a huge fan of that movie. So they're on the spaceship. Everybody's wandering around the spaceship on these levitating chairs, and they're just drinking sugar water and being entertained. Nobody's working. It's just pure entertainment all the time, consuming food and content forever. And there's a Black Mirror episode too. I'm not sure if you're a Black Mirror fan.
I'm a huge fan of Black Mirror.
Oh, man. I love every episode of Black Mirror, except for the first one.
I would say that's my number one advice, is skip the first one. Come back to it, maybe.
Yeah.
Skip it. But no, I was going to tell you, since you mentioned Black Mirror, I would almost say that should be a requirement. If you're going to come interview for this security job, I want to know you understand the nuance here. I love Black Mirror.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorites is Hang the DJ, the one where you find out at the end, this couple, they were dating, right? They're on the dating scene. They kept finding each other. And then you realize, oh, man, they weren't actually dating. They were just running a simulation. 1,000 times into infinity. And then
that's
whenever
right.
you get a match,
the compatibility score.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. So, I remember that one.
Yeah. Bumble is going to turn into that one day, probably. And I'm a big fan of Daniel Meisler. He's got this podcast called Unsupervised Learning. And I feel like he's on the cutting edge of this stuff. I would highly recommend following what he puts out. I follow his stuff and feels the same way. People don't realize how much it's going to change our life. It's going to have a massive impact. I think, too, though, that humans are going to resist. There's going to be like a resistance to it. And the whole world may like separate into two tribes, the pro AI adopters, and then the people who have been hurt by it so much. They're the resistance, the anti AI, like anything to do with AI, keep it away from me. And then there'll be a whole separate economy for those people. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I just watched too many sci-fi movies. We'll see.
You know, I actually have a card game on, differing opinions. And it seems like you can split society any which way, you know, whether it's chicken nuggets or, right? Or everybody has a preference, right? Is it McDonald's fries or Burger King? And you'll probably find that everybody has a position that they take. The bottom line is this: big companies need to make money. And at the end of the day, if they can deliver the same product for 1% cheaper because they're applying a mechanism that's automated, it'll eventually trickle its way into the economy. But what I really want to make sure is that we're not watering down the quality of our products. That's really what scares me, because when you look at Wally, they eat some awful looking food, right? They drink some awful looking drinks. And I didn't see a single homemade cabbage roll meal like your grandma used to make on those tables. It's all just machine created, Matrix world style slop that's flavored like blue or yellow, your choice. The quality of our lives can be degraded by these technologies. And, you know, I worry about that more than anything.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie Idiocracy?
Another golden one. Yes. Yeah, even my kids love it.
How old are your kids?
They're teenagers now. And, you know, they're beginning to explore the world. And we live in suburbia and kind of in a bubble. But I'm trying to get them out of it as much as I can, because I'm really worried about that idiocracy effect. They just try and blend in and just do what everybody else does and set their bar so low. And, you know, it comes with travel. It comes with education. But yeah, we've watched Idiocracy, and I can't help myself. I keep pausing it and saying, do you understand what they're talking? Do you understand what's going on? So eventually they have to take the remote away from me. Just let us watch it, Dad.
Yeah, that's funny. Are you encouraging your kids in any kind of career path? Or I know it's not good to try to force them into anything, but are you encouraging any ideas for them?
Yeah, so what I do, and I think this is a good thing for most parents to consider, is I encourage passion. And so just the ability to have a passion, follow it, learn a skill. If you don't want to stick with it, that's fine. But you have to be doing something all the time. And as far as a particular career path, I look at the bottom dollar. A lot of times what will happen is parents, maybe students would be a better way to look at it. Students are misguided into a direction, and then they come out of school and they have debt and they have no jobs. And so I also remind my kids that at the end of the day, when you have a job, it's there to provide for you. So whatever career path you choose, let's take a realistic approach and see what kind of effort it takes. What's the cost-benefit analysis, what the pay is, and how many jobs exist? I'll give you an example. A friend of mine, she had gone to school for merchandising, and she came out of school, she had a degree, and she couldn't get a job. Well, nobody sat her down and said, this is what the market is. It pays great. Don't get me wrong. The job pays great, but there's only 5 jobs in the U.S. that do specifically what you studied for. It's kind of an extreme version of what happened. And nobody sat her down and showed her that. So I always make sure with my kids, and really anybody who asks me, right, let's look at what this is worth to you. Yes, it might pay great, but there's no jobs available, right? Nobody's hiring. There's only one VP of whatever at IBM, right? And if that's the job you're hoping for, well, you better hope that that becomes available, because nobody else is that. So I try and encourage passion, but also realistic expectations about jobs.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to try to get my boys to become electricians or plumbers and start their own business. And I feel like those services are only going to become more and more in demand and lucrative. And then eventually, you know, as the robots get more capable, right, they can run a trades business like that, and maybe a portion of their staff can be robotics. hopefully not all, but I feel like that's going to take a long time, right? Those jobs are much safer, I feel like, than computer workers. So, but I'm also on the fence about it because I used to tell everyone to get into software engineering, learn Python, learn React, learn how to write code. Now it seems like there's two opinions to where, hey, it's just going to be like a tool that enables us to write code faster. And it's going to be like, if you're on a framing crew building houses, it's going to be like giving somebody a nail gun and a compressor, right?
Right.
You're going to be able to work much faster, or you're not even going to need that at all, right? That's the other opinion, is just going to replace it entirely with a machine. So yeah, I don't know which way it's going to go. I hope that it's just going to be a tool and not a replacer, but I don't know. I feel like I talk way too much about the fear-mongering of AI just because I've seen too many sci-fi movies, I feel like.
Well, I agree with you about the trades. The one thing that trades have that's a guarantee that most industries don't have is that it's local. You can't outsource being a plumber. No, no, it doesn't matter how cheap or how great Indian plumbers are in India, they can't get here, right? And so that's a guaranteed market for trades. And you're right, as much of an improvement as we can bring, they would benefit from it here. I don't see those skills going away. I mean, as long as we produce people, they're going to need those skills around. I just hope that they get paid fairly, again, that you can support yourself. And if that's the case, then we should absolutely go in that direction.
We'll see. I know you're a dad. Your kids are, you know, teenagers. Do they still laugh at dad jokes? Do you have any good ones?
My God, the eye rolling, the exhaustion. They fall asleep practically if I tell a dad joke. We have a few ones, you know, at home here that we tell. I don't know. At this point, they're teenagers, so they're not appropriate. But I could tell you that, yes, as a dad, you absolutely should suffer your way through telling them all the jokes that make them as exhausted and tired and embarrassed as they get, because then they become sort of the family jewels, right? These are the moments you remember.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's one that I like to tell. Hey, did you hear about the kidnapping that happened at the daycare down the street? I mean, eventually he woke up. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but he was napping hard.
That's terrible.
That's so
That's
good.
Terrible.
It's so good. You're going to use it, I promise.
Well, I am going to, I'm going to have to use it. Yes. These days, I'm also trying to learn card magic and whatever else to keep my kids entertained. And it's all terrible, right? They hate all of it. But you know
what
it does?
You play video games?
I do play video games. Poorly, but I do. I hate controllers. I think I'm too old. I need a keyboard and mouse. And not a lot of those games are compatible where you can play against the controller. So if you have an Xbox and your kids give you the controller, you tell them about the good old days, but you can't move the character to the left. So it's awful.
Are they into Fortnite?
No. Thankfully, we managed to skip that whole thing.
You're lucky.
Yeah, they love racing games. They love, like, fighting games. So we'll see what new games we're going to get here. Maybe this Christmas we'll get a new gaming platform. But no, we skipped Fortnite. There was a whole thing with it, and my kids, I think, were too young at the time.
Yeah, I kind of wish my kids, they're still too young. They're 4 and 6, and yeah, they're getting better at it. They're not ready for the Battle Royale or anything, but they can play in the little sandboxes. But my nephews and everybody in their friends group, they all play. They're all so hooked on Fortnite. It's insane. And I even like Fortnite. I mean, it's fun. The characters, the skins, the nice battle royale, you know, the excitement of it all. And it's a repetitive thing, right? You're dropping into the map. There's 100 players and last person standing wins, and you can have a team or whatnot. But yeah, I had an older Xbox and a newer one. So I wanted to play with my kids. So I set the older one up in the living room upstairs. I got the nice one in the basement that I would play on, but yeah, I registered for them their own account, and so that I can play with them on rainy days. We save that for a rainy day, right? Otherwise, I'm trying to get them outside. But if it's raining outside on a Saturday, there's nothing else, like, oh, okay, perfect day. Let's get in the video game world and play together.
Does it work? Do they like it?
Oh, they love it. Yeah, they love it. But I've got 3 kids, and there's one Xbox and me, so we got to set a 10-minute timer, and they have to rotate. I guess they all need their own individual Xbox.
Well, if ever there was a reason. Yeah, then they get into double digits and they develop their own hobbies and likes. And then you just get to watch them sort of right around maybe 11 or 12. They just bring forward and they just run off on their own. But I grew up on first person shooters And I loved Unreal Tournament and Quake before that, and I absolutely enjoyed it. And but like I said, I'm stuck with this whole I need a keyboard and mouse, I need my big screens and gaming PC, and they all kind of scoff at that, and they say, dad doesn't understand, play their games, and I find their games so slow in comparison too. So I don't know, maybe I'm just crotchety these days. And
Yeah, you're an old curmudgeon now. You
yeah.
got no business in the video game world. Yeah, but Unreal Engine, you mentioned Unreal. I played that, but the Unreal Engine 5 is insane. I was just telling, had some guys over at the house last night. We had an outdoor movie playing, and we decided to watch Get 'Em to the Greek, which is funny because I forgot that P. Diddy was in that movie. He has a big part in that movie, and the whole thing's hilarious. But, the character that he plays, watching him play that character and then seeing the shit that he's in right now. Wow. Yeah. That was him in real life. So,
Yeah, I was gonna say, he wasn't acting, was he?
no, not at all. Yeah, that's him. But I don't want to spend any time talking about that situation. But do you want to chat about like recruiting at all? Ask a recruiter anything or chat about hiring? What kind of
Yes, I
questions
would
would you
actually.
have?
Well, so I looked for work just like many people, and I also have friends right now that are looking for work. People getting laid off. And, we all have this sort of, I'm not going to call it resentment, but concern that recruiters these days are not doing their job, right? I'm looking at jobs that are posted on LinkedIn, and there's hundreds of applicants, is what it's showing. And a lot of times we'll apply to jobs and never get a response. So, real quick, just tell me, first of all, so here's a simple question. Should I even bother applying anywhere but LinkedIn? Do I go to Indeed or Monster or any of these other sites? Do you think even a viable means yet to get a job?
Absolutely. You still have to apply. And I would actually recommend using all these sources to find what jobs exist, but then always applying on the actual company website, not on LinkedIn, not anywhere else, not on Indeed, ZipRecruiter, CareerBuilder, any of those. Go to the company website. Number one, you want to see if it really exists still on the website. And sometimes there's jobs that have been made inactive on LinkedIn. It'll say, like, no longer accepting applications. But that just means they exchanged that job for another premium job spot, or they just paused it temporarily, and but it's still actually open. Always apply on the company's website, and that way you don't have to deal with any third-party parsing technologies or anything like that. You get the source of truth and the direct path into their internal system, whatever it is. But then you also want to follow up your application with some LinkedIn work. You got some follow-up work to do. Don't just submit the application and then sit tight and with your fingers crossed. You have to do some active networking and self-promotion. And some of the recommendations I typically give to folks is, try to connect with the people on LinkedIn who you feel like is involved in the hiring process, just based on their job title, maybe some people in talent acquisition and a good mix. But once they accept your request to connect, then you can send them a message. And I would use the audio message or the send a little video message. And you can use that as an opportunity to send them a little micro interview and
Now
deliver
that's
your elevator
interesting. I've
pitch.
never heard anybody say that before, because I've messaged them before, the text message, and a lot of times they'll get ignored.
Big
But
time. Yeah, because there's so many.
yeah.
So how are you going to stand out now? It's through either an audio or a video message. Yeah, go to hrapproved.com to book time now for career coaching and resume reviews. That's a
That's a really
business I
good
started
idea, yeah.
recently. Yeah, that's like a little side business I have outside actually recruiting. And so yeah, I'm telling people this all day, every day. What other questions do you have?
Are people still using recruiters? And I don't mean that at all. I mean, is the recruiting industry shrinking? I know you mentioned AI. I'm really worried that what people are doing is they're replacing their human recruiters with just automated systems that randomly pluck out resumes based on what they feel is compatible. What do you think? Is the recruiting industry getting negatively impacted by automated tools?
It is, but the automated tools are only there because that you basically have to have some type of filtering help due to the volume of applicants. Because, I mean, you post a job now and you get hundreds of applications, thousands, And who has time to look through all those?
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes the person who actually has to screen through all of them, they're not a senior resource. It's like the bottom of the totem pole job, right? Look through all these. So the automation is there to try to show the talent acquisition team who are the best fits based on the role and keywords and all this other stuff. And they can have knockout questions. And you got to remember, there's dozens, maybe hundreds of different applicant tracking systems, and they all have like varying degrees of capabilities. So I'm not just going to sit here and say they all have the ability to like screen candidates. Some of them don't have that at all. You have to, it's everything's still manual, but they're slowly adopting AI and resume scoring and relevancy scoring into the systems. HR departments are becoming more and more reliant on them. So if the relevancy score is not high, you're not going to get seen. And then what a lot of people don't realize is most candidates are eliminated just in the grid view. So when you apply, you're not looking at the individual resumes. You're looking at a grid view, like an Excel spreadsheet looking thing.
Right.
And hopefully the parsing technology has been able to find what your most recent job title is. Right. So you can be eliminated based on a job title mismatch.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're going to look, pull in your most recent company. You can be eliminated just because your most recent company has nothing to do with the industry that the company you applied to is in. Right. They're looking for people that's coming from their industry, probably even a competitor.
Right.
It's going to pull in your location. You can be eliminated because there's a location mismatch because they're, you know, now going to 5 days a week on site. And they're not ready to even give, you know, any kind of entertainment to a non-local candidate yet. Maybe that's like 2 or 3 months from now. They might consider that, but not right now. And why would they? There's hundreds of applicants, you know.
Right.
And so those are the three things. You'll eliminate 70% of the applicants, or maybe 80, just based on the grid view. And then you actually go and look at the actual resume and see if it's got the keywords you need, the technologies you need, the experience level that you need, how many years you need this person to have. Most of the time you wind up with only, you know, at best 5% of the applicants are relevant people that you'd like to interview.
So how do you get your score up high enough? If I had to guess, right, I know they don't use ChatGPT, but what I would do is I would say, go into ChatGPT, throw your resume in there, throw the job description in there, and ask how to tune your resume, what incompatibilities you have. That's my way of using AI to try and understand what it sees. But I'm sure Workday or whatever tool they happen to be using has its own internal that they use to score. How do I get tuned into that?
You definitely want to tailor your resume for every job that you apply to, for sure. And I don't think I would tailor the entire resume, but I would tailor the top half. I would try to match the title they're using, some of the keywords and some of the bullet points, the requirements. Put them in your summary right up top. Make sure that stuff is like the first thing the audience sees without it scrolling anything. You definitely don't want to rely on a bullet point on page two. That's a bad idea.
My summary is actually the most static part of my resume, I would say.
That needs to be the most tailored section.
Huh. Interesting.
Okay. I'll send you a link to pay the fee after. But no.
No, it's because you have summary about yourself, right? A little paragraph that says, and I have so many years and whatnot. And then your jobs and whatnot as you get into more detail. But yeah, I think the first part is the most static part in any resume. Most resumes I receive, they start with an about me, right? And it's a very generic, you know, success-driven manager with so many years of experience in whatever industry. Mine reads the same way. And then you have to look down further to understand how that job or that person is related to my job that I'm filling. That's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, common mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Very common. Everybody does that. Most people will just create one resume and not tailor it a single word and just apply to every job, and they get lazy and don't want to do any follow-up either. So yeah, there's a lot of that. And then the problem compounds on itself due to the volume of applicants. So the real people that are a fit, it's hard to even get anybody's attention just because it's buried under a massive pile.
Yeah, just the noise of it
other
all.
Candidates. Yeah, it's a lot of noise. Yeah, it's a challenging market for sure. And I definitely have a lot more candidates lately than I do job orders. The ratio is kind of sad, honestly. Very few job orders. And I have a mountain of candidates looking. And
right.
I put a lot of content on LinkedIn and other places and, you know, doing stuff like podcasts. People see that. They say I'm a recruiter and they reach out. So I feel like I know about all the layoffs.
Yeah.
I get bombarded. And, you know, so I have a bleeding heart for all of that. And I try to help people the best I can. But a lot of times I can't help you get a job. I can help you fix your resume and do the career coaching stuff, but I also can't do that for free forever. You know,
right.
I have to try to find a way to monetize that information because it's worth a lot of money, you know,
yeah,
to people.
Absolutely.
So, and it's to supplement a weak job market. So yeah, and I'm not the only one. Certainly. I kind of feel like there's probably going to wind up being about 30% less recruiters in the next few years. And then it may wind up being, you know, even half. And then you'll probably start to see the emergence of a new skill set called recruiting engineer or recruiting administrator, where all you're doing is really being an exception handler.
Okay.
For the bots that are in place.
And they're just running the process beginning to end.
Right. Yeah. So the humans won't get involved until later. Right?
Right.
Postings go out, the applications come in, the AI interviews happen, the scoring comes in, you see what the top 10 are, and then the humans get involved. That's how I see it evolving. But we'll see. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong. I don't see it happening any other way.
Well, hopefully it's a little more organic. I've seen some early attempts at digital interviewers, and it's rough.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I actually don't like the AI interviews just yet, but I do like the tools like Kerplunk that's out there where you can give it four or five questions that you want every applicant to answer. And then there's AI behind that. So the AI is not interviewing you. You're just sharing a video interview of yourself, but it does score your answers, and they can't like score your soft skills yet. They just take a transcript of the video and score that. But eventually they'll be able to score your soft skills and your tone and kind of like your attitude.
That would be interesting.
That doesn't exist right now, but
no.
It will eventually. They'll be able to score you as a human in a fit of the job. And then HR departments can just focus on the people that score the best.
Well, I can tell you, I've hired people, and certainly the skill of just summarizing and give me bullets of what their answers are. That alone would be very valuable for a recruiter or a hiring manager. And being able to see how people react on video, there used to be a time where I thought it was a little silly because we went into an office and I thought, you know, just let me see you in person. But now that a lot of people do work behind a camera, you absolutely should be able to function with these tools as sort of an organic way of talking to someone. So I think that makes perfect sense to me. That's a very useful skill to have. Man, thinking that they would analyze your behavior and facial expressions and tone and then give you a score, and then possibly that score would be used to weed you out before somebody even looks at you. That's pushing a little into the black mirror. The mirror gets darkened, right? The black mirror effect comes in hard.
No doubt. No doubt. Yeah, I spend too much time thinking about this stuff. I need to get myself out of Black Mirror mode, but I wake up every day and have the same thoughts.
Have you watched the show called Death, Robots?
No, never heard of it.
If you like Black Mirror, I think you would definitely love this show.
What it does is
it's called Love, Death, Robots.
Where can you find it?
Netflix.
Okay, Netflix. Got it.
I think you would really like it. I think Black Mirror is just all dark. Right. I think maybe there was one happy episode. It's called San Junipero. And everything else, every episode just ends terrible. But Love, Death, Robots, there's a variety there. Just interesting scenarios. And, you know, some are happy, some are sad, some are silly. Definitely take a look.
Sold. I'm watching it tonight. I appreciate the recommendation. And I also saw that you run a blog. What kind of content are you putting out there? What can people expect to see if they visit that page?
So it is a blog. It's slow. I don't create content all the time. I mostly just, when I identify something interesting and get into it, then eventually I write it up just because people, you know, they talk to me about it and I get to a point where I just have a lot to share. So when I lost my job, I started learning about what it is that is a struggle in searching for new work, right? And kind of my experiences. So I wrote a blog about that. When I started learning about artificial intelligence, a friend of mine started telling me about some of the problems that are currently existing and piqued my interest. I learned more about it, became a micro expert, and it just kind of naturally produced a blog entry. So they don't come often, but as interesting topics happen, I write something. And right now I'm writing a story, a two-parter about being a BISO. First one explaining what it is, kind of what we talked about here. And the second one talks about the question of how do you measure a BISO? What are key performance indicators that you can use to measure their success? What you should strive towards? What tools do they use? I have a couple of BISO colleagues in different companies, and we all struggle with the same questions, right? How do you measure success here? And so that's the second half I'm writing right now.
Can't wait to see it. Can you give us a sneak peek on how to measure a BISO?
Yeah, absolutely. So you could say, for example, let's say your cyber team comes up with an initiative. Let's say it's some kind of a data at rest encryption standard that all the database needs to have. Then you take that information and you go sit with your business teams and you say, this is all your databases. We need to encrypt them. This came down directly from our CISO. And then let's say they don't get it done. Do you blame the BISO? Where does the BISO fit into that failure? And so that discussion, really, you need to focus on what was the BISO's role here. And as long as they communicated correctly, as long as they explained what the risks are and the rewards, and as long as they were able to walk their clients through the work that needed to be done, it's not on them if it got done or didn't get done successfully. And then if there is pushback, as long as they communicated it back to the cyber team and tried to facilitate that, they did their job. So where there was failure doesn't necessarily need to reflect poorly on the BISO. And it's important to say, this is where their role starts and stops, and those delineations, right? And then also the toolbox. What do you have as a BISO? The dashboards, the presentations, the skill sets, the website, what should all of that information contain? So it's that kind of thing.
It's interesting. I feel like as the market becomes more aware of this role, a lot of CISOs are going to raise their hand to their CEOs and CIOs and ask, like, hey, can I transition over to the BISO role? Like, I don't want to be CISO anymore. I want to be the BISO.
Yeah, it's no risk, right?
Yeah, it seems like the quality of life would go up.
Yeah, it's interesting. The CISO average lifespan is not lifespan, career span, right? It's getting shorter.
Right.
It's definitely a stressful job. And more they're putting the fault on the CISO if something happens. And yeah, it's an interesting one.
Big time. Yeah. Well, hey, man, it's been fun. You have anything else you wanted to chat about?
No, not immediately. I think we covered just about everything. Hopefully you have enough material.
Engaging.
I really enjoyed my time here today, Blake.
I think so, too. Yeah, absolutely. Likewise. Thank you for coming on. And you've been a great guest. I think you hit a home run on your first one. And this is probably your first of many more. So, yeah, let's stay in touch, man. I wish you all the best. And thank you again for being a guest.
Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed my time here today.
Very welcome, sir.